Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We make our buildings, and afterwards, they make us, said Winston Churchill. Every culture, every era has its defining architecture, from the Parthenon and Roman aqueducts to the New York City skyline and the house next door. Paul Goldberger, Pulitzer Prize-winning critic, wants to remind us of what's beautiful, challenging, ethical, comforting, and spiritual about architecture. This hour on Point, Paul Goldberger, on the built world around us and how it shapes our lives. You can join the conversation, what matters most to you in the architecture that surrounds us. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear from Pritzker Prize-winning architect Richard Meyer. Joining me now from New York is Paul Goldberger. He writes about architectural design for the New Yorker magazine, won the Pulitzer Prize for architectural criticism. He's the leading popular writer on architecture in the country today. His latest book is Why Architecture Matters. Paul Goldberger, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. And this is a wonderful book, a kind of very active meditation on so many beautiful and moving pieces of architecture, not just the great sort of triumphant ones, but some more subtle ones too. And I thought, Paul, since it's Veterans Day, we might start with something so subtle it almost traditionally would not have been considered architecture at all. But we had Maya Lin on the show last week talking about some of her new projects. This is a place at the heart of our sort of a martial memory in this country, the Vietnam Veterans War Memorial that she designed in Washington, D.C. Maybe as a starting point on this Veterans Day, I wish you'd just meditate on that for a moment.
Sure. No, that's a wonderful thought. It's a great, great piece of architecture, and it is architecture. I mean, it's a built construction that has an emotional impact on us and serves a functional purpose, a practical purpose, which is to help us remember. It's an extraordinary story, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, because Maya Lin was a 21-year-old student at Yale when she won a national architectural competition to find a design for it. One of the rare moments when a competition, which sometimes gets a lot of people to come out from under rocks and produce junk, actually yielded an extraordinary and brilliant design by an unknown architect who never could have had a chance at all at doing a job like that but for the competition. And it was very controversial for a while because it's quite abstract, very modern in some ways. As now probably everybody knows, it's this very long wall that slices into the earth and looks almost like a cut in the earth, but is very subtle. It gets higher and higher as you go down. It begins as just a tiny, almost like a curb, and then gets longer and longer and deeper, and the arms of the, and make forms a V, and the arms point to the Lincoln Memorial and the Capitol, very subtly tying together the great monuments of Washington with this painful moment in our history, which was the Vietnam War. But then, so as to make it very clear that the point of this is not to discuss the larger national pain, but to honor the individuals who died, the wall has the name of all of the 50,000 Americans who died during the war. And it brought about a great understanding of the role of the individual in a collective memorial.
Give us a sense of how that happens. You've been involved in the 9/11 Lower Manhattan memorial consideration. I mean, here we are again. It's Veterans Day. You say, among other things, architecture is the making of place and the making of memory. We're in more wars, and eventually, presumably, these wars too—Iraq, Afghanistan—eventually will be memorialized one day in architecture. What's the process by which we distill it down? Is it just accident? Is it whimsy that a Maya Lin comes along and then that becomes, or is there some, are the fates at work here in what ultimately emerges as the concrete, you know, point of memory?
Well, the fates are always at work. The fates in a curious combination with individual genius or individual lack of genius. We have, not that far from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, another example of a memorial in Washington that's relatively recent, much more recent, in fact, the World War II Memorial, which I think is kind of clunky and heavy-handed and doesn't work at all. It's a lot of classical elements arrayed around a reflecting pool, commemorating the different states, which seems very odd because the states themselves didn't play a role in World War II, and there's no mention of the battles or the other things that defined that war. And it just seems sort of tired and heavy-handed and sort of clunky. And I do not find it inspiring or evocative of memory. On the other hand, the Lincoln Memorial is one of the greatest buildings in all of Washington, maybe in all of the United States, and proves that using classical elements, using elements from architectural history, is not in itself the problem. It's how well you use them.
You see, it's sort of deceptively classical with those those famous columns around a very, in some ways, stark internal cube.
Absolutely right. You know, you've seen it exactly as it should be seen. You know, one thinks that that's just a knockoff of the Parthenon, but in fact, the more you study it, the more you realize it's in fact a brilliant, almost radical reinvention of the Parthenon for a whole new purpose. It's turned on its side. The roof is different. It's all much cleaner and sharper and more abstract. And in fact, it's been remade into an American thing with the recognition that by the time it was finished, of course, in the 20s, no one was around anymore who knew Lincoln. People who had any knowledge of the Civil War were gone or going very fast. And it was going to have to communicate to future generations who were not there. That's really the great question with memorials. They have to be able to communicate to people who do not have memories of their own. And how do they do that?
No direct memories, that is. This
no
is a
direct
kind of a
memories,
cultural
right.
memory that embodied in a memorial. Anyway.
That's exactly right. And in fact, one of the things I talk about in the book is how architecture creates cultural memories. You know, we all have our individual memories of architecture. There's a chapter called Buildings and Architecture and Memory. We all have our individual memories of architecture that may go back to your childhood room at school, your childhood room at home, and your kindergarten classroom or what have you, which are surprisingly vivid for a lot of people, even years and years later. And yet there also are shared cultural memories of architecture. And something like the Lincoln Memorial is one of those. So are things out of movies and plays and literature. I mean, architecture appears everywhere, and it's a presence even in a lot of works of literature, powerful presence, like a character.
You have great examples here from both the establishing sort of shots that take us to a particular aspect of a city or place, use architecture to set up an entire movie.
Yes, absolutely.
And then North by Northwest, you've got the example of a Cary Grant clambering around on that very open, very modern house set, what kind of above Mount Rushmore? Is that the idea
anyway? Exactly.
But open, but not at all open. Hitchcock has him clambering around secrets behind glass.
Right, exactly, which is so brilliantly Hitchcockian. I mean, there you know, you see Hitchcock brilliantly exploiting modern architecture and our imagery of modern architecture and twisting it for the purposes of this amazing plot of this wonderful movie.
Vitruvius, writing in ancient Rome, you remind us, he set out the three elements of architecture. It's so rare we get to pull the curtains all the way back and look really big picture. But the three elements, this is from, 2,000 years ago. He said, architecture, the three elements are commodity, firmness, and delight. Instruct us, Professor Goldberger.
Well, you couldn't say it better than Vitruvius, I'm afraid. I mean, he got it right then, and we've never been able to improve on that. He understood that architecture isn't just one thing, but all things. By commodity, he meant usefulness. Obviously, it has to serve a function. It has to fulfill its function somehow. Firmness, it has to stand up. It has to be structurally well-built. So architecture is not only a practical thing, it's an act of engineering. But finally, delight. Architecture has to bring joy and pleasure. It's architecture when it's really running on all cylinders is art as well. But it's not only art. That's the great fallacy, is those who believe architecture is art the way painting or sculpture is art. It's not as simple as that. It's not only art, but it's not not art either. If it's only practical, then we've lost some of its potential. But if it's only art, it probably won't serve its commodity, its usefulness very well.
You're a great critic of architecture. How do you look at the time in which you're working, Paul? Is this a rich time? Is this a strip mall hell time? How do you look at it?
Well, will you allow me to say both?
Yes.
You're right. It's both a rich time and a strip mall hell time. We're doing a lot of really wonderful things today. We produce great buildings of a type that we've never made before, which is proof that the art of architecture is alive and continually inventing itself, as culture has to do. It has to keep inventing itself as it does in literature or music or painting or dance or film, what have you. But we also produce a vast amount of junk. And in architecture, the junk matters too, because it's around us all the time. You know, you can turn off some music if you don't like it. You cannot read a book if you don't like that. But you can't avoid architecture so easily. It's there. It's just there. And I think in many ways our greatest challenge today, our greatest problem in architecture, is not the great buildings, which we can do when the occasion warrants. Mm. It's our inability to create ordinary buildings that bring the same kind of pleasure and satisfaction that the ordinary buildings of a generation or two or three or four generations ago brought. The ordinary buildings of the 19th century are more pleasurable than our ordinary buildings.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic Paul Goldberger about the built world around us and how it shapes our lives, maybe even our dreams. His new book is Why Architecture Matters, and it takes a big, sweeping look at architecture across time, very deep into our own. You can join the conversation. What's the architecture you love? Is there a building, a tower, a house, a bridge, a city whose architecture particularly moves you? Are there hundreds or thousands of those? And are we all moved, shaped every day by the buildings around us? How, in your case? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Paul Goldberger joins us from New York. He's columnist for The New Yorker magazine, has the Skyline column there. And you can read an excerpt of his new book at our website, onpointradio.org. Paul, you write about ethical architecture, and I have to say I'd never thought about it in just that way, but what is meant by ethical architecture? This is really getting down to how it affects us, shapes us.
Well, ethical architecture is architecture that in some way helps society and doesn't hurt society, let's say. There are a lot of things we could put in the category of ethical architecture, I suppose. Sustainable architecture, green architecture, is ethical in a particular way because it puts less of a strain on the planet. You know, buildings are our greatest consumers of energy. We all focus on cars and the internal combustion engine, but the reality is buildings use a lot more energy than all the cars put together. So that's one aspect of ethical architecture.
But you go all the way back to Alberti. Mm-hmm. This is 15th century Italy, saying that. There's some great quote, like I'm not sure if it was him or someone writing about him saying, "Beauty in architecture, perhaps, has the power to disarm the raging barbarian. No greater security against violence and injury than beauty and dignity,
right,
even in architecture, I guess."
Right. And now I'm not entirely sure there wasn't a little bit of wishful thinking in that quote.
Yeah.
Beauty alone is not likely to disarm most barbarians, particularly barbarians in the 21st century. But that doesn't mean there is not an ethical imperative to make architecture as good as we can, to make life as good as we can. Another aspect of ethical architecture, mm-hmm. I think, is architecture that serves a meaningful social purpose. Architecture that houses the poor, architecture that helps to feed people is ethical architecture in a certain way. There we get into another touchy area because, of course, it's not always in the power of architects to determine what ethical architecture we build. You know, people talk about the urgent need, say, for more housing. Mm-hmm. But architects alone cannot decide to devote the resources of our society to building more housing for the homeless. They might be able to do it very well if society were to turn to them and say, okay, here's your next assignment, do it. But they can't in themselves create the assignment. You know, architects need clients. That's another difference between architects and artists. Mm-hmm. Artists can paint or draw what they please, and the work of art is finished and exists. Architecture is only an idea until there's a client who says, now build it.
Mm-hmm. Not a writer in his garret or a painter in his studio just hoping to sell it.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
Take a little skipping tour through history.
Sure.
We want to come up to date. But when you look, just to give us a sense of how in different eras, different examples of architecture have either, propelled a culture in a certain direction or bring us the cultural memory of an era?
Mm-hmm. Well, architecture is really the greatest memory of an era. Or at least as great as works of literature and music and painting. When you go into a city like Rome and you feel the powerful layers of time, and the meaning is in fact in the communication over time. It's not just the old stuff. It's the old stuff combined with the new stuff, with the medium in between stuff, and so forth. It's the conversation between the generations, to quote a line from Vincent Scully, that makes architecture, I think, so meaningful in a cultural way and even in a psychological and emotional way for us. That feeling that as you're walking down the street, you're seeing things that have been added to the conversation by each generation over time, and that they're communicating with each other and ultimately with you and me.
And you sort of, I mean, you point at the pyramids or the Parthenon or Chartres or Taj Mahal or St. Paul's Cathedral right on up to our own, Louis Sullivan and Frank Lloyd Wright. And at that very high end, there's a kind of conversation across the centuries as well.
Yes, absolutely, between the masterpieces and the meaning of something like the pyramids or the Parthenon or Chartres Cathedral or what have you extends across cultures and times completely. But this book is very definitely not a sort of tour of great works of architecture around the world or around time. In fact, it tries to devote as much attention to how, as I said before, your childhood bedroom when you were 6 years old might have affected you as much as the pyramids, if you're lucky enough to see the pyramids. And to talk about the importance of the ordinary landscape and cityscape and townscape around all of us, the things we see every day, and the great things and how they kind of play off against each other, and together all of them create our own sort of sensibility and feeling.
Paul Goldberger is with us. His new book is Why Architecture Matters, and we've got a lot of listeners who want to speak with you. Let's go to East Lansing, Michigan, and Mark, you're on the air with Paul Goldberger.
Hello, fellas. Interesting discussion. I have a literally nuts and bolts question.
Sure.
I'm an artist and photographer, but I was raised by a civil engineer who supervised some very big structures like the Renaissance Center
in Detroit. Right.
I had my little junior hard hat for going on site, but I never really knew what qualifications are required of an architect regarding structural engineering. If you could inform us, I'm wondering, would an architect confer during his design, aside from just the aesthetic outside design and appearance of a structure? When I lived in New York for a few years, I did enjoy, on close examination, observing the Guggenheim. Despite the genius of Frank Lloyd Wright, if you look up, at least a few years ago, you could see that all around the wall of that, or the facing of the balconies that corkscrew upward, about 1 foot up from the bottom, there was a a crack in the concrete.
Mark, let us pick it up. The engineering side of this is a great question. And for that matter, the sort of role of technology in all of architecture.
Sure.
Paul?
Technology has always played a huge role in architecture and determined what we can build. The Gothic cathedrals, for all we talk about their profound beauty and ability to move us, were also brilliant exercises in avant-garde engineering. They were the most advanced engineering possible in their time, as were the pyramids, of course, as well. We're always kind of pushing the technological envelope, and that determines a lot of what we build. In the case of Frank Lloyd Wright and the Guggenheim, Wright, in fact, went almost a little beyond pushing the envelope. He really tried to reinvent engineering himself and usually got away with it pretty well. Wright, in fact, had a very good understanding of engineering. Yes, the Guggenheim did have some cracks. Falling Water, his amazing and staggeringly beautiful house cantilevered over a waterfall in western Pennsylvania, after about 50 years, had to be reinforced by modern engineers.
You're very forgiving of that. You say
I am very well.
Examples where the engineering we shouldn't complain if it starts leaking after 50 years because
well,
it's
a lot of great architect. Well, I am somewhat forgiving. I mean, great architecture has often leaked, I'm afraid. I mean, there's a lot of buildings that have leaked over time, and if I lived in one of those houses, I'd probably be less forgiving. One of the great things about architecture is that most of us don't have to live in great buildings at every moment. I'm sure that the Kaufman family that commissioned Falling Water, or Madame Savoy, who built the Villa Savoy outside of Paris by Le Corbusier, who had plenty of difficulties with that house.
She was very bitter about it.
She was very bitter about it in the end, and actually an even more painful story was that of Edith Farnsworth, who built the most famous Mies van der Rohe house in America, the Farnsworth house outside of Chicago. She ended up suing Mies van der Rohe after the house was finished. But, you know, we don't all have to live with those problems. We get to enjoy the aesthetic as we tour the house and then go home again. So it's easier for us in a way. Now, but to get back to Mark's original question, no building of any size or substance is built without a consulting engineer. And engineers have often told architects, no, you cannot do this. Or we can help you figure out a way to do your idea, but you may have to adjust it a little bit this way or a little bit that way to make it possible. That happens all the time. You know, I'll be in Boston next week to give a talk at Trinity Church. And I've been looking into the history of Trinity Church, the great church by Henry Hobson Richardson on Copley Square. And that church has an amazing central tower. Originally, Richardson had wanted it a little bit differently. And the engineers and contractors said to him, we just can't build it that way. Sorry, buddy. You know, you've got to redesign it a little bit.
Can't be done.
And it can't be done. And they sort of found a meeting point in between. He adjusted his design somewhat. The engineers sort of pushed very hard to see if they could figure out a way that they could guarantee that it would hold up. And they did. And it all worked. And it's been there now for 130 years quite magnificently.
Where's the leading edge now of avant-garde engineering? What are the examples you'd point to? I mean, you've got a photograph in the book, among other things, of the CCTV headquarters in Beijing. This very angular, tall building people might have seen during the Olympics. Famously had a big fire not that long ago now.
The fire was actually in an adjacent building that was part of the complex that was to be a Mandarin Oriental Hotel, joined to it, but not the actual tower itself. The CCTV tower by Rem Koolhaas and the Office for Metropolitan Architecture.
And tower's a funny word because, you can describe it.
It's a tough building to describe, actually. It's kind of, imagine a tower that's actually a square, two parts going up, a part across the bottom, and a part across the top, a square donut. And then imagine it's kind of twisted and torqued.
Yeah.
So the top part actually forms an L in space as well. So the whole thing just keeps twisting and turning like a gigantic square pretzel, 50 stories high. Mm-hmm. It's a remarkable building. The engineering would not have been possible a generation ago, or perhaps even less than that.
Yeah.
You know, today we're at a point where computers are permitting us to do all kinds of things that were simply impossible some years ago. Frank Gehry's great Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, which was finished in 1997, is a building that Gehry quite famously said could never have been designed
without computer software. Arcs and curves,
right,
and like wing upon wings.
Figuring out how to engineer that, if they'd been doing calculations by conventional means, the engineers would still be sitting with their papers and slide rules and all that if we were in that period. So what technology allows us to do now is the computer can figure out all of the stresses in a particular form and, in effect, design a structural system for it. It can also create models from drawings, actually turn them into three-dimensional models. It's amazing the technological leaps, say, in the last decade in architecture, and they are changing the forms of buildings. A building like Eero Saarinen's TWA terminal at Kennedy Airport, built in about 1961, with its swooping concrete walls, was very, very radical in its time. It's now beloved as an old icon of the early days of jet travel, and it's a very beautiful building. It was, in fact, a very primitive attempt to do, by more conventional means, the kinds of things that computers now make very easy. And you can it's now economical to do a fast food outlet looking like that, if you
right,
want,
right,
because the computer allows you to produce it so quickly. And so we've got a lot of swooping, curving buildings running around. Whether we will continue to remains to be seen, but because, of course, if we can do something, that doesn't necessarily mean we should or it's the best way to go. But it means we definitely will for a little while we get it out of our system.
I mean, at one time it was genius permitting those, you know, Brunelleschi in the Duomo in Florence, or
right,
Michelangelo in St. Peter's. Now, I guess, the genius plus computers. Is the U.S. at the cutting edge when it comes to this now, or is it overseas? Is it Asia with their resources?
It's harder to be specific in an age of globalization, which has really affected architecture as much as everything. You know, the great architects in the United States build all over the place, all over the world. Mm. And in turn, we've got a lot of really important buildings in America now being built by leading architects from elsewhere. That's become more and more the case. Everybody big has a global practice now. But you're absolutely right. I mean, genius is still part of the equation. The computer could execute Frank Gehry's design for the museum in Bilbao, but it couldn't create it. It is still very much an individual act of creative design, that building.
Absolutely. And I love your other observation that in an age where more and more of our lives are lived in a virtual realm, this is the one that keeps us concrete. Architecture is, by definition, it's not digital. Computers may produce it, but it's the real. We walk in it. We sleep in it.
Absolutely. Architecture is the real thing. Architecture is about the material world. That's why there's a chapter in this book that's called Architecture as Object, because at the end of the day, for all we can talk about all the other things, and they're very important, but it's also a thing. It's a thing in front of us and a thing we're in and a thing we experience as part of the real and material world in an age when so many of our experiences are virtual ones. We communicate by computer, and so forth.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic Paul Goldberger about the built world around us and how it shapes our lives, our dreams. His new book is Why Architecture? matters. In just a moment, we're going to hear from the great architect Richard Meyer. Let's take a couple of callers first. They've been waiting so long. Christine, Norfolk, Virginia. Christine, you're on the air with Paul Goldberger.
Hi. I'm so glad to take my call. Thank you. All my life, I've kind of wondered, everything is always up above the earth and so visible, and I know architecture is very beautiful. I really don't know much of it, but I really enjoyed him saying that it was a commodity and that there was a firmness to it and then a delight.
Yes.
And a surprise at the end. And I'm wondering if anybody is out there doing anything that more incorporates the landscape into it, the architecture is part of the earth, so that when you're is blending the natural forest or the desert or the lake, so that when the community might come home, I know it sounds like you're going underground, but maybe somewhat, you know, so that the homes are blending in with the natural environment. I was just wondering about that.
Sure. There have been, over the years, a lot of architects who've played with those ideas. In fact, Frank Lloyd Wright designed a couple of houses long ago that were partly underground and had landscaped roofs. And today, with the whole movement toward green architecture, sustainable architecture, the idea of the green roof, where you actually grow things on the roof, has become very much back in fashion again. Renzo Piano, a great Italian architect who's done quite a number of museums in this country, just finished a science museum in San Francisco called the California Academy of Science, with a whole undulating roof that is planted and is really like a landscape in itself.
In Golden Gate Park in San Francisco.
It's in Golden Gate Park,
yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Yesterday,
yep.
Yeah.
Wow. Wonderful building.
Fantastic. Do you see the urge or necessity of environmentalism radically changing architecture in this century?
I don't see environmentalism changing architecture as much as a lot of people might have expected, not because it's not there and important, but because it's become so much taken for granted, so expected, and so much a part of architecture that we're actually incorporating it well into conventional, not conventional, but into architecture of a sort we might have had even without it. And by that I mean that think about how a few years ago when people first started talking about energy and buildings, everyone said, oh, well, that's the end of the glass building. We can't have any more glass buildings. And then, in fact, the glass manufacturers figured out how to make glass perform much, much better now. And so, in fact, we've got more glass buildings than ever, which you may think is a good thing, you may not. But it is a proof that, in fact, we are able to incorporate environmental issues sometimes into architecture without completely changing the look of it.
Paul Goldberger's new book is Why Architecture Matters, and it gives us a wonderful and rare chance just to stare straight at architecture, kind of the heart of it. We have one of the greatest architects in the country with us right now. Richard Meyer joins us from New York. He's a winner of the Pritzker Prize in 1984. He's designed many famous buildings, including the Getty Center in Los Angeles, the High Museum in Atlanta, Frankfurt Museum for Decorative Arts in Germany, and Hartford Seminary in Connecticut, Athenaeum in New Harmony, Indiana, many more. Richard Meyer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. I'm pleased to be with you.
Way back when you won that Pritzker Award, sort of the top of the mountain for architects. You said then, when I am asked what I believe in, I say I believe in architecture. What did you mean by that?
Well, I believe that, you know, architecture is really an art. It's the art of creating meaningful space for human habitation, space which we live in, we move through, we exist in, and it's really the creation of space is what we do as architects.
The creation of space. I mean, space exists with or without, does it not?
Well, space is all around us, but when we define it, when we create something in which you are in a space, that is what architecture is about. It's not about being in the sky. It's about human scale, the relationship of people to a place, and that's what makes our cities great. together.
And I wanted to ask you, I've had sort of a few California days just now in San Francisco and Los Angeles. I was just gazing on your Getty Center a couple of days ago. Of course, you're famous for buildings that are wonderful and very often white. And Getty Center, huge and beautiful on its hilltop there. You may have heard Christine just calling in from Norfolk, Virginia, talking about an architecture maybe more engaged and even part of the earth. As someone who's designed in white and very much above the earth, what about a century of heightened environmental concern? Do you see architecture changing, Richard Meier, getting cozier to the earth, more of it?
Well, I think that, today the sensitivity to sustainability in everything that we do is very acute, but it's not new. We've been doing this for years. We've been considering all of the things which now I think is more or less in the popular vocabulary. But this is not something new to architecture. The relationship of what is man-made to what is natural has always been a concern. And in my architecture, I believe that there's a difference between what we make and nature. Nature is growing, it's changing. The colors of the day change. Architecture doesn't change. It's static. And there's a relationship between that which we make and that which is natural. And architecture, in a sense, reflects nature. It refracts the colors of nature. And the whiteness, I think, helps accentuate one's awareness of all the changes that occur throughout the day and throughout the seasons, because the whiteness enhances all of the changes and colors of what's around us.
Paul Goldberger, you wrote not long ago of Richard Meier and his work. You said a Meier building is a sensuous experience before it is anything else. It's an exploration of solid and void and light and mm-hmm. texture. Maybe if you could just use Richard Meier's work, which I think many people will have in mind from the Getty Center and others, as a kind of a point to look out at what's going on today in architecture. Where does it fall in the range of high architecture going on?
Well, Richard Meier's work, I think, is exceptionally beautiful and elegant and emerges out of the belief that sometimes you respect nature best by not trying to imitate it, which would be kind of crude in a way, but by standing gently upon it rather than imitating it and just creating a beautiful object that feels in every way man-made, rather than trying to mimic mm-hmm. nature. And that's how, in fact, you show your respect for nature. I think that's something Richard Meier is trying very hard to do and generally does very successfully. You feel in his spaces that you are in a man-made place, but a man-made place of extraordinary beauty and proportion and light and that has a kind of refinement that, to me, very much symbolizes this age of high tech as well. It's interesting because Richard Meier's work has been a pretty consistent aesthetic for a while, but in a way, it feels almost more right today as we live in this age of electronics and high tech and a kind of very detailed perfection of things that's permitted by digital technologies. Richard Meier's work seems to reflect, symbolize that in a certain way.
Let me take a call while I have both of you here, if I may. Christopher in Boston, you're on the air with Paul Goldberger and Richard Meier.
Hi, Mr. Ashbrook, Mr. Meier, and Mr. Goldberger. This is quite an honor to speak to all three of you. I've certainly read Mr. Goldberger's work over many years and admired Mr. Meier's work. I'm the son of an architect, so I'm either cursed or blessed, depending on how you look at it, with...
Maybe both.
viewing, yes, exactly. Viewing my environment first from the built perspective. So I go to a city and I see, what does it look like before I get into the social side of things and whatnot? So I guess my question is this. I mean, actually, the discussion's ranged so widely in the last half hour or so, and I've revised my question so many times. But let me just narrow it down to this. I despair. I'm literally standing in a Home Depot at the moment.
Okay.
And I despair at what's around me, and that it's, you really have to work hard to get something that actually is both functional and aesthetic at the same time. And I look around at the same thing with buildings, whether it's McMansions or the strip malls, and I wonder where we've gone wrong, I guess is how I put it, in that we as a society allow these things to kind of infiltrate our life, and so that I think Mr. Goldberg, you said earlier about how we do great buildings when the need, you know, arises.
Right.
But it's the ordinary and the everyday that we don't do well. And so I guess I'm wondering, why is it that the common man, so to speak, who comes into Home Depot is almost impossible to walk out with something that isn't flawed in some major way? And why is it that the common things that are available to us, whether it's the housing that's built or the strip malls that are built, that are... maybe it's our governance or whatnot that pushes us into what I would say is a very mediocre state.
Let us pick it up, Christopher. And if I may, Paul, let me put it first to Richard Meyer. I mean,
you're
the high architect. Here's our caller standing in a Home Depot. You hear his question.
This is a very interesting and important question, because all around us is really non-architecture. Unfortunately, there's probably was no architect for the Home Depot building where you're now located. If there was, it would surprise me a great deal. There's so much that's built that is not done by architects. It's done by builders, developers, people who really don't care about architecture and feel that it's much more economical to them just to build something as cheaply as possible in order to create an enclosure, but it's not architecture. And when we look around, all around us, unfortunately, most of the housing that's done in the United States is not done by architects, it's done by builders.
But is this unique to our time, Richard Meyer? Is it in all times? Many buildings have just been built by people with hammers.
All times, but I think that it has always been that way, but perhaps in the past, people were willing to do things of a little bit better quality than they are today.
Paul, what do you say to Christopher's question?
Well, I think it is a very important question, absolutely. I say a couple of things. First, as I said earlier, it is the critical problem of our time, in a way, is not great buildings, which we can produce, but ordinary ones. Buildings need to do a little more than just keep us, out of the rain. And many of them stop at that, which is a real problem. That said, however, I do think we need to feel sort of a level of comfort with our ability to create a kind of ordinary thing that is not necessarily a major aesthetic experience, but is just okay and not offensive to the eye either. And that's what we could do once in the 18th and 19th centuries and part of the 20th centuries. Awful lot of houses were just built by builders, mm-hmm. but they followed there was kind of a social contract, a common understanding that they would look a certain way that we now look back at history at these things and think was actually pretty good. A plain old New York brownstone or what have you is now something we admire, but we value it highly, and yet it was quite ordinary. Why can't we do something ordinary now that's as good? It's an absolutely key question. All of that said, however, I do want to say that I think despite the experience Christopher's just had at the Home Depot, things have gotten a little bit better in the mass marketplace in terms of design. I mean, if he were calling us from IKEA rather than the Home Depot, I'd say, he might be reporting on an experience that was better than what he could have had 20 years ago, where, there is at decent prices in the mass marketplace a certain amount of quality design available. We are seeing that happen to a certain extent. And that's all to the good, I think. But it doesn't solve the big architectural problem of our cities, our landscapes, our towns, and so forth. However, I'm also going to play the devil's advocate in one last quick final comment, which is to say that perfection, I think, in its own way can be kind of deadly. And I don't know that we want cities in which absolutely every building were absolutely perfect, that part of the energy of cities comes from the fact that they're at least a little bit messy and surprising. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I, as you know from everything I've said and written, I value and treasure Richard Meier's work. On the other hand, I don't know that we would want a city in which every single building were designed by Richard Meier. I think, in fact, you know, it's the interplay between different sensibilities and different circumstances creates the continually surprising cityscape that we love and value when it's at its best.
Richard Meier, we just have a short time here, but Paul Goldberger was talking earlier about the globalized culture of everything, including architecture these days, and certainly you do work around the world. Where do you see, speaking of energy, where do you see the energy in architecture now, globally?
Well, there's no question in my mind that China is putting more energy into building and doing creative things than any single place that I know of. But, you know, there's good architecture being done throughout the world. I see wonderful things being done in South America. I see extraordinary things being done in this country and in Europe. So there's no one place that stands out. But I think the energy that's being put into building in China is without question much greater than in any other place in the world.
We're going to look to the east tomorrow as President Obama heads out to Asia. But this has been a wonderful conversation this hour right here on Architecture. Richard Meier joining us today from New York. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Paul Goldberger, author of the great new book, Why Architecture Matters, really a fun intellectual treat, this book. Paul, thank you very much for the book and for speaking with us about it today.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.